So there you are, awake and sitting there at 3:14 a.m. and the fridge buzz stops, which leaves this silence that's it's so heavy that it almost feels like a physical weight in your body, and you're spiraling. The rumination and all that. You're sitting there looking at a chipped coffee mug and maybe a stack of mail that you haven't opened because honestly, what could possibly be in there that's going to change anything for the better, right? And you realize that the person you were 10 years ago, the one who thought life was just a series of obstacles to be cleared, that person was an idiot. But you don't even feel this in a self-hating way. It just arrives like it's a simple fact, without all the harsh judgment. So we are taught that pain is an interruption, like it's a glitch, a scratch on a DVD that makes the movie skip. And we're told to just cheer up and get over it. Or my personal favorite, use it as fuel. As if our internal agony is it's just some raw resource that we can refine into a shiny new personality whenever we need to do that. But sitting there in the dark, watching the dust motes drift in the light of a street lamp or something, that all feels like a lie. A well-intentioned, desperate lie. So a few days ago, I saw a guy, a middle-aged guy, wearing a suit that looked like it had basically given up on him. He was standing at a bus stop, and he looked rather crestfallen. He wasn't crying. He was just staring at I guess, a crack in the sidewalk with this profound intensity that made him look like he was almost like a statue. So he had this look of total silent inner drowning. And people walked past him, looking at their phones as people do. And the loneliness of it struck me because it wasn't the I don't have any friends kind of lonely. It was deeper than that. It was the I'm experiencing something for which there are no words kind of lonely. And then another guy walked up and they started chatting. I think it might have been someone he knew. And this new guy says something like, well, it could be worse. And then he proceeds to provide examples of why it could be worse and why his suffering wasn't as bad as compared to, I don't know, examples X, Y, and Z. And that made me cringe a little because this is what you call a fallacy of relative privation. And it's an idiotic notion because it's like telling someone whose leg is on fire that they should feel better because the guy next to them is currently being eaten by a bear. Pain isn't a ledger. You don't get to subtract someone else's misery from your own to find some comfortable balance. You know, it's interesting because suffering is remarkably greedy. It wants to dominate the whole room. There's a philosopher named Elaine Scarry who wrote about how pain actually destroys language. So when the pain gets bad enough, you drop the fancy adjectives and the metaphors. You're basically reduced to a sound or various sounds like a grunt or a whisper or whatever. So it's like this is like the ultimate solitude because you're trapped in a place where not even your vocabulary can follow you. Many of us have been there at one time or another. So in a way, you're like a ghost in your own kitchen, trying to explain the why of it to a toaster that doesn't give a shit. And the why usually is the wrong question anyway. Sometimes I think my sensitivity is a gift, and that being attuned to the world is some sort of soulful superpower or something. But I also see it as like an evolutionary middle finger. So we're wired to feel things that we have no control over. And we've developed these massive, complex nervous systems just so we can feel bad about the fact that a cartoon robot sacrificed itself in a movie, for example. Or that eventually we're going to turn into a handful of carbon. This is like a species-wide level of self-sabotage because we're the only creatures on the planet that spend a Tuesday afternoon worrying about our own obsolescence while eating a lukewarm burrito. So there's this phrase that we've all heard, and it seems like a lot of people love this phrase. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Which is a nice thought that probably looks good on a gym wall. But I think it's objectively false because usually, in truth, what doesn't kill you leaves you with a permanent limp and a weird flinch when someone moves too fast. And it leaves you with trauma and scars of varying permanent damage. You get the idea. Talk to a boxer who's been in the ring for 20 years. He survived every fight, and he's technically still there. But now his knees hurt and his memory skips sometimes. And, you know, he pauses halfway through sentences trying to remember where the thought went. That's basically most people at some point in time. Survivors with a lot of damaged or missing pieces. the writer Jean Emery, this is the guy who survived Auschwitz, argued that once you've been truly traumatized, you lose your trust in the world. And that's the part that never grows back. You can be happy again, eventually, sure. But that fundamental belief that the floor won't suddenly vanish from under your feet. That's gone. So you spend the rest of your life checking the structural integrity of every room you walk into. And yet, nonetheless, there's this weird pressure to recover, to overcome, you know, be a survivor, which just really feels like another chore. Like I have to perform my healing so that other people feel less uncomfortable looking at my scars. Some of us just get tired of being a survivor. Sometimes I want to be the guy who got hit by a boat or something, and now I'm just hanging out in the kelp feeling kind of shitty about it and not be judged for it, you know? There's an honesty in the limp, because it's a physical record of the fact that something actually happened. If we pretend the wound made us better, we're just lying to ourselves to make the pain feel somehow worth it. But pain, it's not a transaction. You don't put in 3 units of sorrow and then get back 4 units of character. Sometimes you just lose the 3 units and then you get a permanent headache. All right, so the first of the 4 noble truths of Buddhism is the truth of suffering. It's number 1 on the list for a reason. That being said, the first noble truth isn't supposed to be some pessimistic Yelp review of existence. It's meant to be just an observation. Like saying water is wet or the DMV is going to take 4 hours. It's an axiom. But we treat this like it's a personal insult. And we walk around like we're shocked, actually offended that things break or that people leave or that we eventually get old and our knees start to sound like gravel in a blender or something. So we have there's this concept of the second arrow, which comes from Buddhism. So the Buddha, or whoever was ghostwriting for him, talked about how if you get hit by an arrow, it hurts badly. That's the first arrow. That's the physical pain, the job loss, the divorce, what have you. But then we spend the next 10 years shooting ourselves with a second arrow by ruminating. Why did this happen to me? Or it shouldn't be like this. And this goes on and on and on. And you replay it, you obsess over it, and you imagine all the ways it could have been different. And every one of those thoughts lands like another arrow in the same spot. The second arrow is actually the one that kills you. Because it's the craving for reality to be something other than exactly what it is right now. It's this desire to control something that you can't control based on clinging and attachment. So it's an internal argument that never ends. Like a form of self-torture that makes the first arrow actually hurt 10 times more. And it doesn't matter if it could be a minor mistake or a catastrophic loss. It's going to turn any wound into a slow bleed. We are just a series of cravings held together by a nervous system. And we're addicted to the idea of permanence, which is a bold move for a species that can be taken out at any moment by a microscopic virus or a lunatic with nuclear codes. So we ignore the impermanence of everything because it's unbearable. It's like looking, well, if we look at it directly, it's like looking right into the sun or the abyss, I guess, whichever is your preference. So we cling and we attach ourselves to identities and to jobs or to people, to the way your partner looked in 2016. And when those things inevitably shift and dissolve, and they will, we feel like we're being robbed. But the thing is you can't be robbed of something that you never actually owned. It's all temporary. All right, so let's talk about Emil Cioran. So he was a philosopher who wrote a book called On the Heights of Despair, which sounds kind of like something a goth teen would have highlighted in his bedroom. But Cioran, he was a different kind of animal. He was basically a professional insomniac who spent his nights wandering the streets of Paris, probably staring at the Seine and wondering why anyone bothered to get out of bed. He had this idea that our lyricism, our urge to create and to speak, make art, it doesn't come from a place of health. It comes from an organic collapse. In other words, our lyricism is primarily a response to the trauma caused by the human condition. You start singing when you're too miserable to stay quiet. It's a release. And yes, it's a bleak way to look at creativity, I suppose, but it is a type of catharsis. And I think it actually feels more honest than the, you know, follow your bliss mentality. Pain is the kindling, and boredom is the oxygen. If you're perfectly comfortable, you probably don't write an essay or write a song. You don't make any art. You just kind of sit there and exist, which is fine, of course, but it's not particularly interesting. So Cioran argued that we only become true individuals when we're in pain. When everything is going well, you're just part of the herd. You're a consumer. But when you're lying on the floor at midnight alone, staring at the ceiling, wondering how you're going to pay rent or why your chest feels like it's full of wet cement. That's when you are actually you. Turin also argued that suffering is the only thing that's truly yours. No one can feel your toothache for you. No one can carry your grief. So it's like the ultimate private property. And there's a strange, dark humor in that. Turin was actually an intensely funny guy in a gallows humor kind of way. So most people spend their lives trying to be special in some way, and then eventually life gives them this incredibly specific, but deeply uncomfortable self-awareness that belongs only to them. And then they spend the rest of their lives trying to ignore it or just get rid of it. And maybe this is why we're so obsessed with fixing ourselves. We think we are a broken machine, but what if the broken part is actually the most functional part? And I know that sounds kind of illogical, but what if the anxiety and the sadness and, the feeling of being out of place, not fitting in, that's just the barometer working correctly? I mean, if you're not at least marginally horrified by the world, you're probably living in denial and you're not paying attention. And the fact that it hurts, that's the proof that you're still plugged in. So in a sense, it's the shadow of everything you actually care about. And you only feel the vacuum because there was something there to begin with. The problem with wallowing in suffering is that it becomes a full-time job with terrible benefits, where you spend all your energy maintaining the shrine to your own misfortune. So it's a victim mindset, and it's a trap. It's a seductive trap because it's the only place where you're always right. If you're the victim, you never have to move. You're the protagonist of a tragedy. And, tragedies don't require some 5-year plan. They just require an audience and a lot of sighing. So the thing is, there is a sizable difference between this happened to me and this is who I am. All right, so Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, once said that when we can't change the situation, we're forced to change ourselves. Easier said than done. And I know that it sounds like something you'd see in a sunset-themed postcard in a therapist office, but Frankl wasn't really the positive vibes only kind of guy. He was a realist. And he knew that no matter how bad things got, the only thing that they couldn't take from him was his inner freedom to decide how he was going to respond to the nightmare of living in a Nazi concentration camp. That is what radical acceptance is. It's not a passive, I like this. This is fine. It's more like looking at a broken pipe in your basement while the water is chest high and saying to yourself, okay, the basement is totally flooded. This is the current reality. Now, do I want to stand here screaming at the pipes or do I start swimming? Personally, I'm probably going to swear at the pipes while I'm swimming, but that's just me. I guess we all have our different ways of coming to acceptance. Acceptance is the relief of the inevitable. It's like that moment in a movie where the car is sliding on the ice and the driver finally stops white knuckling and steer at the steering wheel and just lets go. And then there's that split second of this bizarre combination of terror and peace right before the impact, where you're no longer fighting the physics of the universe. You're just a passenger in your own life, and it's actually kind of liberating for those terrifying few seconds. And if you stop demanding that the world be fair, and you stop being disappointed when it isn't, there comes a quiet and gritty kind of strength. It's not the strength of a weightlifter. This is more like the strength of a coastline that just lets the waves hit it and the tide come in and out day after day without filing a formal complaint with the moon. There is this idea that has been sold to us that life is like a mountain that we're supposed to summit. And it represents your career, your relationships, and so forth. So you're always looking up into the future, and you're convinced that once you reach the peak, you'll catch your breath, and finally, you'll be able to see everything clearly. Finally, you can start really living your life. And yeah, there maybe there's a beautiful view once you get up there. But I think you quickly realize that nobody actually lives on the summit because this concept of the summit is really, it's an illusion. The reality is that we live down in the lowlands where the dirt is and the water collects and where the trees are growing and where there's the mosquitoes bite and where things fall apart and rot. It's not a path to somewhere else. It's just the place where you happen to be walking. So when you see life from this perspective, pain stops being an obstacle and it becomes part of the scenery. You know, maybe it's just a dark patch in the woods that you have to walk through. You don't have to like the woods. you don't have to find meaning in the thorns that scratch you. You just have to keep moving and just try to remain present and aware. So I looked at that chipped coffee mug again this morning, and now there's a crack running down the side of it, and like it looks like a little lightning bolt of imperfection. Now I could throw it away and buy a new one, a perfect one, but then I'd just be waiting for the first chip on that one too. And it made me think that the crack is the point. Maybe this whole edge of the abyss thing isn't a cue to jump. It's just a place to stand for a minute, and where you look at the drop, and you let yourself feel that weird, you know, magnetic vertigo of realizing how fragile and impermanent everything is. And then you turn around and you go back into the kitchen and you make a sandwich anyway. So you acknowledge the void, but you still put the mustard on the bread. Dijon, in my case. We're not being led to some grand finale here. I mean, eventually the sun is just, it's going to stop hitting the floorboards and the path is going to get too dim to see. And, you know, we all know how the story ends. There's no winning at life. There's no trophy waiting for you. There's just, you know, what we have is the rhythm of your own breathing and the way you choose to hold yourself while you're still moving. We spend so much time trying to find a cure for the human condition, whether it's a pill, a prayer, a philosophy that we think is going to make the gears stop grinding finally. But maybe the grinding is the music. And the despair that Chiron talked about, it's not a pit that you fall into. It's a level of honesty that you finally reach when, you know, you're too tired to keep up the act anymore. I don't see radical acceptance as a white flag of surrender. To me, it's a map showing you the terrain and saying, yeah, this is it. This is the whole thing. And there's an odd and cold comfort in realizing that you don't have to fix your life, because your life isn't some broken appliance. It's a process, and processes don't need to be fixed. They just need to be accepted as they are in the present moment, until they're finished. All right. That's all I've got today. As I always say, thanks for listening.